6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine. Discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Lawyers, when did you realize you were defending someone truly dangerous? Story 1. I was a young public defender, eager and idealistic. One of my early cases involved a man accused of assaulting his ex-girlfriend. The evidence was shaky, no clear witnesses, conflicting testimonies, and a victim who didn't show up for court. My client was soft-spoken, polite, and always had this eerie calmness. He'd smile a little too long, hold eye contact a second too much, but I chalked it up to awkwardness or nerves. Then, during a strategy session, I brought up the ex-girlfriend and how her absence would help our case. He leaned in and whispered, "She won't be a problem. Not anymore." I laughed nervously and asked what he meant. He just stared at me and said, "Sometimes people disappear when they talk too much." I tried to convince myself he meant she moved away or didn't want to testify. But then I found out, after our case was dismissed, that she was actually missing. Vanished a week before the trial. No trace. And he never once asked about her again. Just thanked me for my good work and walked out a free man. I quit public defense 2 months later. Story 2. I once worked for a private firm that handled white-collar crime. One client was a charming CEO being investigated for fraud. Seemed straightforward until the SEC started handing over documents and bank records. Something didn't sit right. He'd always brag during meetings about how loopholes were just part of the game, and how real power is when you can make people disappear with a wire transfer. The real moment that broke me? He called me at 2 a.m. drunk, rambling about a whistleblower who won't talk again. I dismissed it as just bluster. A week later, I found out that same employee had died. Officially a car accident, but it was bizarrely timed. When I pushed the issue, my client smiled and said, "It's amazing how fragile breaks are, isn't it?" I reported everything I could and left the firm shortly after. I still wonder what else he got away with. Story 3. I represented a guy charged with aggravated assault after allegedly stabbing his roommate. His story was that it was self-defense. No priors, held a steady job, very normal on paper. But every time we talked, he would fixate on morbid details. He'd ask, "Do you think arteries squirt the same for everyone?" Or, "If someone screams while bleeding out, is that admissible in court?" He'd giggle, actually giggle. One day, I noticed he brought a notebook to our meeting. I glanced at it. It had stick figure drawings, graphic ones, of people dying in various ways, notes beside them like quick or satisfying. I asked if he was seeing a therapist. He said he was, and that the therapist likes his creativity. I checked. He lied. There was no therapist. I did my job. The jury acquitted him due to lack of evidence, but I didn't shake his hand when it was over. I walked straight out of the courtroom and sat in my car for an hour. I'd just helped free a man who enjoyed thinking about murder. Story 4. My client was a woman accused of poisoning her elderly father. She was wealthy, refined, very intelligent. Her defense was rock solid, medical anomalies, lots of paperwork, even a doctor on her side. But as we prepped for trial, she kept slipping in details about her father's failure as a parent, how he owed her, and how his life had no purpose anymore. It was uncomfortable, but not illegal. Still, during one meeting, she smiled at me and asked, "Have you ever read about arsenic and how the taste is masked in wine?" She said it with curiosity, like someone describing a new perfume. Then she added, "It's amazing how many people drink alone when they're depressed." The jury found her not guilty, and the day after, she sent me a thank you basket. Inside was a bottle of wine. I never opened it. I threw it out the same day. Story 5. I was defending a teenager, barely 17, accused of animal cruelty. At first, I thought it was just stupid behavior gone too far. Kids do dumb things, right? But the more I talked to him, the more unsettled I became. He described his actions in vivid, detached language. He'd say things like, "I wanted to see what color their insides were," or, "They stopped fighting after the second cut. It's boring after that." He never showed remorse, just curiosity, almost like a scientist without a soul. During our last meeting, he looked at me and said, "Next time I'll pick something bigger. Maybe people. You'd still defend me, right?" I reported the statement immediately. Authorities eventually found journals in his room, detailed plans for escalating. It wasn't just cruelty, it was experimentation. The case never went to trial, he was institutionalized, and I started sleeping with the lights on. Story 6. He was a college professor, charged with assaulting a former student. Everything about him screamed, respected intellectual. PhDs on the wall, symphony season tickets donated to charity. He had a refined vocabulary, called me counsel, and always arrived with a briefcase full of...
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Organize documents. At first, I believed he was being framed by a disgruntled student. But then he started bringing up unrelated women from his past, casually mentioning female colleagues who knew better than to accuse him, and how some women need to be reminded they're not invincible. The way he said it, measured, thoughtful, like he'd spent years justifying it in his mind. One day, I got a call from his wife. She wasn't even on the radar. She whispered into the phone, terrified, said she wasn't allowed to speak during his lectures, even at home, that he kept a journal where he ranked women's obedience. She begged me not to let him know she called. I tried to keep it professional. But during our next meeting, he looked straight at me and said, "Careful who you listen to. Weak minds attract weak consequences." I finished the case. He pled to a lesser charge, but I told the firm I'd never work with him again. Some men don't need weapons. Their mind is the knife. Story 7. I was court-appointed to defend a man who'd broken into a home and held the family at gunpoint. He claimed it was a robbery gone wrong. On paper, it was violent, but not uncommon. But as I prepped the case, weird things started happening. He would send me letters, handwritten, almost poetic, talking about seeing fear in their eyes and how power is a currency people don't understand. At first, I dismissed it as a deranged attempt to gain attention. But then I got a visit from one of the victims, off record. She said he hadn't taken anything. No money, no jewelry. He just made them line up, made the father cry, and then left. He didn't want money, he wanted dominance. What chilled me most was when I asked him what went wrong that night. He leaned back, smiled, and said, "They didn't break as easily as I'd hoped. After sentencing, I filed to transfer all violent offender cases off my roster. I couldn't keep pretending people like him were just Misguided. Story 8. I had a client who ran a series of assisted living homes. He was being sued for neglect. Several elderly residents had suffered severe malnutrition and untreated infections. He insisted it was all a misunderstanding, blamed staff, poor regulation, even the families. I love those old folks, he'd say. They're like grandparents to me. But when I reviewed internal emails, it became a horror story. He referred to patients as cattle, used terms like liquidate the bed blockers and milk the Medicaid corpses. I asked him point blank what he meant. He laughed and said, "You think I'd pay to keep vegetables alive for $400 a month? This is a business." One email chilled me to the core. Don't treat bed sores unless someone from the state is scheduled. Prioritize those who complain. The lawsuit was civil, not criminal. But I quietly leaked documents to the press after the trial. He lost the business. I sleep better knowing that. Story 9. She was a teenager, barely 18, accused of hacking into her high school's grading system. Seemed like a stupid but fixable mistake. She was quiet, soft-spoken, even shy, said all the right things in court. Teachers vouched for her as brilliant but socially distant. But during one prep session, she asked me, "What if I said I only did it to see if I could control people with it?" I asked what she meant. She said, "I changed grades, then watched how people treated each other. Popular kids panicked. Nerds got praised. It was like God mode." She had charts, timelines, behavior maps. She didn't do it for herself. She wanted to watch people squirm, and she smiled when describing it. I still won the case. Charges dropped. She was a first-time offender. But I never forgot what she told me as she walked out. "Systems break if you poke them hard enough. Next time I'll try banking." Story 10. My firm took on a man accused of running an illegal animal fight ring. On the surface, he was cooperative. Denied everything, said he just bred dogs for sport shows. During discovery, we received photographs. Not just of dogs, but of children. Standing near the fights. Laughing. Cheering. I asked him what was going on. He shrugged and said, "Kids need to grow up tough. Better than staring at phones all day." It got worse. One document revealed he'd offered backroom shows for extra cash, inviting clients to bring their own animals. No rules. I told him it was monstrous. He smiled and said, "You ever seen what a pit bull can do when it smells blood? It's beautiful." I excused myself from the case the next day. You can only pretend someone deserves fairness until they proudly tell you they don't believe in it. Story 11. My client was a small-town mechanic accused of setting his neighbor's shed on fire. On the surface, it was petty, a property dispute gone too far. He said the neighbor owed him money but denied everything about the fire. Then I started noticing strange things. He had this notebook he carried everywhere. I thought it was a calendar or appointment book. Turns out it was full of diagrams, not cars, houses, with exits marked, fuel lines noted, and wind direction calculations. I asked him what they were for. He said, "Just in case I need to remind someone not to cross me." I froze. The fire at the shed wasn't random. It was practice. There were more pages. Homes of people he'd argued with. Some names were crossed out. I asked if those people moved. He said, "No, they learned their place." I couldn't prove arson for the others, but I knew. I knew I was looking at a man who played with fire like chess. I finished the case. But I warned the DA off record. I still check the news for fires in that area. Story 12. A wealthy real estate developer hired us to fight fraud accusations tied to inflated appraisals. Seemed like a paper crime. No blood, no weapons, just greed. But once I met him, I saw it wasn't just about numbers. It was about domination. He had a voice like a preacher and a temper like a mafia boss. He told me, "I don't build homes, I erase weakness." That line stuck with me. Later, I discovered he'd pushed entire families out of rent-controlled buildings. Not legally. He paid off enforcers to harass them, cut off water, sent inspectors to intimidate. One mother was hospitalized after being shoved during a fake inspection. He called it motivational eviction. When I confronted him, he said, "Poor people rot buildings. I clear infection." We settled before it went to trial. He donated to a hospital after, made headlines, but I knew it wasn't kindness. It was camouflage. Story 13. He was a pediatrician accused of prescribing opioids unnecessarily. At first, I thought it was another overworked doctor caught in a policy net, but his files were off. Dozens of kids getting meds far beyond dosage limits. When I pressed him, he deflected, said parents were demanding, and he was just trying to help. But then came the letters, anonymous ones, from parents. One said he asked their daughter to come to appointments alone. Another said he gave meds but no physical exams. The worst part? A note from a nurse who claimed she quit after hearing him whisper to a child, "You're my secret." He smiled through every deposition. I don't know how deep it went. Charges were dropped due to lack of hard evidence, but I still see his face when I hear the word predator. Story 14. My client was a career criminal, charged with robbing a pharmacy. I was used to him. Loud, smug, no respect for the system. But this time, he was different, calmer, almost spiritual. He kept saying he was on a path, that the signs were all aligning. I assumed it was prison talk, some self-help phase. Then I found the manifesto. He left it in the file folder by accident. 30 pages, handwritten. It wasn't about the robbery. It was about cleansing, about targeting corrupted healers, pharmacists, doctors, therapists, who drown society in weakness. He had a list. 7 names. The pharmacy was just the beginning. I reported it. He denied it was his, said someone planted it, but the handwriting matched court documents. He knew the pharmacist's routine down to the minute, knew when her kid got picked up from school. He's in federal custody now. I made sure of it. Story 15. She was a quiet older woman charged with check fraud. Sweet voice, crocheted during meetings. Said she didn't know her bank account was being used in scams. I believed her, at first, until we subpoenaed her financial records. Dozens of deposits, all under different names. When I asked, she said, "Sometimes people need to share space in your life, even if they're gone." Creepy, but it got worse. I found receipts for cemeteries. She'd been writing checks to fake memorial funds in names that matched recently deceased people from obituary columns. One of them was a child. When I asked why, she said, "They visit me at night. I owe them." I didn't know if she was mentally ill or just playing a role, but I saw the house during a follow-up. Dolls, hundreds of them, each labeled with a dead person's name. She didn't need money. She needed their presence, and she was using fraud to build a shrine. We pled insanity. I still don't know if it was an act. Story 16. I was assigned to a man accused of assaulting 2 EMTs during a wellness check. He claimed it was self-defense, said they broke into his house and provoked him. He was calm in court, well-dressed, articulate. But in every meeting, he obsessed over surveillance, not legal surveillance, the signals. He talked about frequencies, controlling thoughts, and accused the EMTs of trying to upload commands into his brain. It was unsettling, but I've dealt with mental illness before. Then I received a package at my office. No return address. Inside was a thumb drive. It contained video footage, grainy, silent, of my house, my kids playing outside, my wife leaving for work. The footage was clearly taken from a parked car across the street. There was one message: "Now you know they watch us too." I called the police immediately. Turns out he had dozens of recordings, judges, neighbors, his own sister. He wasn't just paranoid, he was documenting everyone, building dossiers. The case was transferred to a psych facility. I moved my family. Story 17. My client was a middle-aged man charged with impersonating a federal officer. Seemed like a sad guy chasing power he didn't have. He even made his own fake badge out of a belt buckle and laminate. But when we searched his home for evidence, it stopped being funny. He had built a full interrogation room in his basement. Soundproofed, single chair, spotlight, lined with tools, not work tools, instruments, custom-made restraints, scalpels, wires, all clean, organized. He had scripts, full pages of questions labeled for liars, for children, for traitors. When I confronted him, he didn't deny it. He said, "Justice has to come from somewhere. If the system's slow, you help it along." He'd never hurt anyone yet, but I could feel it. He was preparing. The courtroom wasn't his battlefield. The basement was. I asked to be removed from the case. I still think about what might have happened if he hadn't been caught playing dress-up first. Story 18. I defended a woman accused of identity theft. She used dozens of aliases and had opened credit lines in at least 6 states. Seemed like a run-of-the-mill grifter. Charming, too. She'd smile, compliment your tie, ask about your kids. But there was something off. She never slipped up, never panicked. Every alias came with perfect backstories. Different handwriting, different accents. She even had social media accounts for them. Then I got curious. I dug a little deeper than usual. Two of her identities were tied to women who had gone missing. One in Arizona, one in Maine. When I asked her about it, she just said, "Some people leave the world willingly. I just help fill the space they leave behind." Her laptop had folders named after those women. Pictures, journals, voice clips. It was like she absorbed them, became them, lived as them. I notified the authorities. She skipped bail before the court date. Last I heard, she was spotted in Florida, under a new name. Story 19. My client was a retired military contractor accused of assaulting a teenage boy. He claimed the kid was trespassing on his land. Classic rural defense. But in court prep, he started rambling about training failures and discipline protocols. He wasn't talking about the boy. He was reliving combat. He had a detached look in his eye when he described pinning the kid to the ground. Said he used non-lethal holds. The boy had a fractured collarbone and ruptured spleen. Later, he handed me a file he made. It had maps of local schools, timetables, bus routes, notes on potential threats. I asked him why. He replied, "They need order before the world burns. I'm just prepping for phase one." He believed society was collapsing and saw himself as a future warlord. Assaulting the boy wasn't the crime, it was the rehearsal. I handed the file to the feds. "He's not in a cell. He's in a bunker, monitored 24/7. Story 20. She was a high-powered executive accused of embezzlement. Cold, efficient, not a wasted word. She didn't deny skimming. She denied it was wrong. She told me, "Resources aren't stolen. They're reallocated, and I'm better at using them than the rest." I thought she was just arrogant, until I discovered her spreadsheet. It wasn't just money. She had tabs for people. Co-workers, board members, each had a rating. Loyalty, threat level, potential leverage. There were action plans. Blackmail, seduction, coercion, color-coded, updated weekly. She wasn't running a company. She was running a calculated manipulation campaign. And when one employee tried to report her, she leaked photos of his affair, anonymously. It worked. He resigned. I told her this wasn't defensible. She said, "I'm not asking for defense, I'm buying silence." I left the case, quietly. A week later, she emailed, "Wise move, you would have scored low." Story 21. He was a traveling nurse accused of stealing painkillers from multiple hospitals. My initial impression was sympathy, overworked, underpaid, perhaps struggling with addiction. But in reviewing incident reports, a pattern emerged. He wasn't stealing to use. He was replacing them with saline or worse, expired drugs. In some cases, he'd carefully swap labels so no one noticed. One hospital flagged him after a patient coded mid-surgery, a young man who should have been stable. When I asked my client about that case, he smirked and said, "I gave him a real shot at strength. His heart just wasn't in it." I was stunned. He kept referring to his job as playing God in increments. He said modern medicine was too easy, and he was testing natural endurance. Later, they found a diary in his apartment, a twisted experiment log, detailing which patients responded best to diluted meds. The charges expanded to include manslaughter. I withdrew the next morning. Story 22. My client was a philosophy professor charged with stalking a student. He claimed it was all a misunderstanding, that they had a deep intellectual bond. In our meetings, he spoke in riddles, often quoting Nietzsche or Foucault, talking about power and consent in abstract terms. I chalked it up to eccentricity. Then the student's journal was submitted into evidence. She documented dozens of encounters, him waiting outside her classes, mailing her handwritten notes, slipping books with underlined passages into her locker. One line haunted me. "Pain is just the price of awakening. You'll thank me someday." When I asked him about it, he laughed and said, "Some minds must be shattered before they can grow." He didn't want love. He wanted psychological dominance. I argued for a plea deal. He refused. Said courts were a spectacle for the ignorant. During the trial, he tried to cross-examine her himself. The judge shut it down in seconds. The scariest part? He was eloquent, convincing. A few jurors almost bought it. Story 23. She was a corporate HR director accused of blackmail. A few employees claimed she threatened them with termination unless they cooperated. No one gave specifics. At first, I thought it was a political hit job. Then she handed me her insurance portfolio, dozens of flash drives, each labeled with names, each containing surveillance footage, secretly recorded office conversations, parking lot arguments, private phone calls. I asked how she got it. She said, "Power means never needing to ask." She'd spent years compiling data, knew who was cheating, who was embezzling, who was mentally unstable. She said it wasn't blackmail. It was strategic leverage. I said it was illegal, she countered. Only if I lose. She won the case. Not enough direct proof. A month later, a reporter who was writing an expose on her retracted everything and quit journalism. She sent me a bottle of wine after. I didn't open it. Story 24. My client was a teenager charged with vandalizing a cemetery. Spray paint, smashed headstones, animal remains, all brutal, all disturbing. But he pled, just a prank. What bothered me was his eyes, not scared, not defensive, excited. I requested a psych eval. The court agreed. During the assessment, he told the doctor about the ones below, said they ask for gifts, and the headstones block their vision. He described rituals, names that didn't exist, and a plan to make the earth thinner. I got access to his notebook, dozens of pages of symbols, some ancient, some made up. He'd drawn detailed maps of burial plots and circled graves of children. I confronted him. He said, "You wouldn't understand. They whisper only to me." He didn't need a lawyer. He needed a priest and a team of psychologists. He's in long-term psychiatric care now. But the part that sticks with me, he wasn't scared of the voices. He missed them. Story 25. He was an IT manager for a mid-sized firm, charged with planting spyware on co-workers' devices. A data breach had exposed sensitive client info, and he was the only link. In our meetings, he was humble. Said he was just checking for performance issues. I believed him at first. Until I read the files, he didn't just track keystrokes. He monitored webcams, microphones, copied personal files, tax documents, emails with therapists, even private medical records. And he categorized them. A rating system, useful, weak, loyal, disposable. He had a folder called Assets. It included notes on how to manipulate individuals, what scared them, what they'd hide, who they'd protect. When I asked why, he said, "Control creates calm. Chaos is just unorganized data." The breach was intentional, a stress test. He wanted to see how people reacted under fear. The company settled quietly. He walked. I shredded every note I had. He wasn't a hacker. He was a puppeteer. Story 26. He was a respected pastor arrested for aggravated assault. The police report said he beat a man nearly to death in a motel parking lot. His defense was that the man tried to rob him. During our meetings, he was poised, quoted scripture, said he forgave the victim but still wanted to see justice done. The congregation backed him, hundreds of letters of support. But things unraveled fast. The victim had no criminal history, just a hotel clerk, a quiet guy with zero reason to attack anyone. When I confronted my client, he calmly said, "The Lord sometimes uses violence as a tool. I was chosen to cleanse." Then he showed me a list. It was handwritten, titled Vessels of Sin. There were names, dozens. People he claimed were tempted and marked. He'd written the offenses next to each name, some minor, like gossip or jealousy. Others just had the word unclean. He wasn't defending his faith, he was executing it, one person at a time. I turned over the list. He's serving life now. I left religious defense cases for good. Story 27. My client was an ex-park ranger, charged with setting forest fires. He denied everything, claimed it was lightning or careless campers. I wanted to believe him. He seemed like the type who'd die protecting nature. Then we got the drone footage. One fire started in a straight line, deliberate, controlled, the way professionals would do it if they were training. When I asked him about it, he smiled and said, "The forest needs to burn to breathe." That wasn't the worst part. He kept a journal, pages upon pages of fire descriptions, not scientific, poetic. He described flames as cleansing serpents, the smoke as truth rising. One passage read, "I decide which roots deserve rebirth. Some trees are guilty, some towns too." There were circles on a map, small towns all near dense woodland. Five had already had unexplained fires. Two more were scheduled. I gave the map to investigators. He's in a high-security psychiatric prison now. I never went camping again. Story 28. She was an elementary school guidance counselor arrested for theft and data breach. The district claimed she hacked into confidential student records. She said it was a technical misunderstanding, but she had pages of notes, not just files, personal observations about kids, who cried easily, who lied, who had troubled parents. There were color codes ranking them on suggestibility. I thought it was for behavioral reports, until I saw the next binder. It was titled Future Roles. Each child had predictions. Follower, exploitable, leader, defiant. With hypothetical scenarios. She wasn't helping kids. She was programming them, running psychological simulations in her head. Some had red check marks next to test soon. I confronted her. She smiled and said, the earlier you shape them, the more permanent the mold. She pled guilty to unlawful access. No charges on the psychological manipulation. She moved out of state. To this day, I wonder what she's molding next. Story 29. He was a former soldier turned fitness coach, arrested for assaulting a gym member. Claimed the guy had threatened him, that it was all self-defense. Body cam footage didn't fully disprove it, but clients started coming forward. Not with accusations, with fear. Said he made them sign weird contracts, tracked their phone data, knew their routines. One said he showed up at her house uninvited. Another said he monitored her menstrual cycle for optimization. It got darker. In his home, police found a hidden room lined with whiteboards. Each board had names, exercise schedules, photos, food logs, sleep patterns. It wasn't just training, it was control. I asked him about it. He said, they give me access. I shape their weakness. They owe me loyalty. He wasn't building muscles. He was building followers, worshipers. He saw himself as their new god of discipline. I left the case. The firm took heat for dropping him. I didn't care. I saw what he wanted to become. Story 30. She was a wedding planner arrested for grand theft after a client accused her of vanishing with deposits. Her excuse? The client breached the emotional contract. That phrase stuck with me. When I dug deeper, I found more brides. All said the same thing. She became obsessive, inserted herself into personal decisions, changed venues without approval, showed up uninvited to family dinners. One bride broke the contract mid-planning. That same week, her house was vandalized. Dead flowers thrown across the lawn, mirrors shattered. No proof it was the planner, but her emails were haunting. She'd write things like, "You desecrated the design. I will balance the chaos." I got access to her storage unit. It was filled with wedding memorabilia, centerpieces, photos, vows, none of which belonged to her. She collected them, dozens of unfinished love stories. She didn't want money. She wanted perfection, her version of it, and anyone who ruined it became her enemy. She walked free. No one could tie the evidence directly to her, but I've warned every engaged couple I know since. Story 31. He was an amateur magician arrested for unlawful surveillance. He claimed he was filming reaction footage for a prank show. Said it was harmless. Everyone laughed at his charm during arraignment. But when I reviewed the footage, it wasn't funny. He had hidden cameras in dressing rooms, restrooms, hotel hallways. Hundreds of hours. The worst part wasn't what he recorded. It was how he edited it. Each video was cut and spliced with disturbing narration, like he was building twisted character arcs. Labeled them things like the humiliated queen or the unfaithful brother. He told me, real reactions are the best illusions. You just need the right pressure. The creep factor skyrocketed when I realized he wasn't uploading these anywhere. They weren't for clout. He watched them privately, memorized them, cataloged every subject's breaking point. He wasn't a magician. He was a voyeuristic puppeteer. The DA took a plea, but I made sure my firm dropped him. He still sends me birthday cards, blank inside. Story 32. She was a city code inspector charged with harassment and unlawful entry. Said she was enforcing safety compliance and was being targeted for doing her job. But victims said otherwise. She'd show up unannounced, sometimes in the middle of the night, walk into backyards, peek into windows, always wore gloves. I obtained her notes, expecting a log of violations. What I found were observations, personal ones. About people's routines, when they fought, what time they showered, which rooms had lights on past midnight. Some pages had weird phrases like still testing the limits or subject 14 now aware. I confronted her. She didn't deny it. Just stared at me and said, it's not about rules, it's about patterns. She'd used her job to embed herself in people's lives, to monitor how they broke under pressure. She wasn't documenting safety. She was measuring fragility. The court barred her from city work. I requested a restraining order against my own client. Story 33. He was an 11-year-old boy charged with arson after setting fire to a neighbor's garage. Juvenile case. Everyone expected a slap on the wrist. But during our intake, he calmly described how long gasoline takes to ignite depending on wind speed. He drew diagrams, labeled where accelerants were placed. I asked why he did it. He said I needed to test my timing. We searched his room. Hidden behind dresser drawers were sketches of the whole block, notes on who was home during what hours, a page labeled most flammable targets. At one point, I gently asked if he ever thought about hurting people. He smiled and said, not yet. The fire was a warning shot, a practice run. The court sentenced him to therapy and monitoring. I hope it's enough. Because if he ever stops drawing and starts acting again, someone's not walking out alive. Story 34. She was a volunteer counselor at a crisis shelter. Arrested for embezzling funds through fake invoices. Seemed like a white-collar mistake. She insisted it was for operational costs. Said the paperwork was a mess and she took the fall for bad management. Then a staffer came forward. Turns out she wasn't just skimming money. She was selectively denying help. Blacklisting certain people based on personal judgment. Unworthy, she called them. When I dug deeper, I found printed intake forms with handwritten notes like, too weak to change. Liar. Needs to hit rock bottom. Save the resources for fighters. She played God in that shelter, decided who deserved to live indoors and who needed more pain. Her calm demeanor masked a kind of calculated sadism. She pled guilty to financial fraud. No criminal charges for the denied aid. I still wonder how many people she left on the streets to freeze. Story 35. He was a quiet janitor arrested after a co-worker disappeared. At first, there was no connection. He was only being questioned. I was just present for precaution. He didn't flinch once during interviews, said all the right things. But something was wrong. I asked if he knew the missing man. He said, yes, I cleaned his space the night before. That detail wasn't public. Then I saw his notebook. Tucked inside his locker, next to a box of bleach and rubber gloves, the notebook was filled with hand-drawn blueprints of the building. Vents, crawl spaces, sewer access, routes that even security didn't know existed. One page had a checklist. Avoid cameras. Keep soil soft. No witnesses. Wait 3 months before next. We got a warrant. Behind the boiler room wall was a cavity. Inside, bones, fabric scraps, a belt. He never confessed, just said, you can't mop away decay. You bury it. I left criminal defense permanently after that case. Story 36. He was a motivational speaker arrested for inciting a violent incident at one of his retreats. He claimed it was a misunderstanding, that a guest had a mental breakdown and injured another attendee. But during discovery, I received footage. He had a ritual called unshackling. It involved isolating one person from the group, then forcing them to admit their fears on camera. He'd surround them with others chanting, expose, cleanse, break. In one video, a woman is visibly crying, trying to leave. He blocks her path and says, you leave when your weakness dies. When I questioned him about it, he said, pain reveals who we are. I simply hold the mirror. He had these files, too, on every guest. Psychological triggers, trauma histories. Use them as pressure points. The incident wasn't an accident. It was a culmination. The charges stuck, but I still wonder how many retreats went unreported. He was building something cult-like under the guise of self-improvement. Story 37. She was a forensic accountant hired by the state, now charged with obstruction after allegedly hiding critical evidence in a high-profile fraud case. Her defense was that she didn't want to compromise an ongoing investigation. Sounded plausible, until I started noticing gaps in her documentation. Whole transaction chains removed, key names blacked out. I confronted her. She looked me dead in the eye and said, "Not all truth is meant for court." Later, we discovered she'd built a private ledger. A shadow financial map that tracked not just embezzlement, but blackmail payments, political bribes, hidden pensions. It was meticulous, too meticulous. She wasn't covering for anyone. She was controlling everyone. Her goal was leverage, to be the invisible axis everything spun around. She had emails saved, signatures forged, deathbed confessions ready to be leaked if needed. She pled guilty to a minor charge, walked with a fine, and I've never trusted a spreadsheet again. Story 38. He was a local historian charged with trespassing after being caught inside an abandoned asylum. Said he was writing a book and just got curious. The police found him with lockpicks and a flashlight. I assumed it was urban exploration. Then I visited his apartment. The walls were covered in patient photos, not pinned, stitched into fabric panels, names, dates, even diagnoses embroidered around them. It looked like a museum display from someone's nightmare. He'd been tracking patients from the asylum, not just from public records, from restricted medical archives. One of the files he had was for a patient declared dead in 1963, yet he'd written across it, "I spoke to her last week." When I asked him about it, he said, "Places don't die, they dream, and I listen." He wasn't trespassing, he was communing. The charges were dropped, nothing criminal stuck. But I kept that case file in a box far from my desk, because I'm not convinced he was alone in that asylum. Story 39. She was a young baker accused of putting glass in a cake sold at a wedding, denied it all, claimed her ex-boyfriend, the groom, was trying to ruin her business. It seemed believable, until I got her laptop. She had recipes, dozens, all altered. Some added harmful substances in trace amounts, detergent, uncooked beans, even allergens, each labeled with events, job interview, sabotage, breakup, moderate damage, reunion, high shame. I asked her why she kept them. She said, "Emotions need flavor, pain needs texture." She'd been crafting emotional bombs disguised as desserts. She didn't care about the law. She wanted to leave a mark on every person who wronged her. Some reviews even hinted at it. Brides who got sick, co-workers who had allergic reactions, all dismissed as coincidence. The groom had recognized the taste and the intent. She pled out, got probation, her bakery shut down. "I haven't eaten anything homemade by a stranger since." Story 40. He was a mechanic who beat a customer unconscious in his garage. Said the man threatened him. No one could prove otherwise. But I dug into surveillance footage from nearby stores. This wasn't a heat-of-the-moment attack. My client had followed the man for days, took photos, made notes on his parking routine, even logged the times he was alone. When I asked why, he said, "Some people need to be corrected, like bent axles." He didn't see people. He saw defects. Turns out the customer left a 1-star review a year prior. My client had logged it, waited, then acted. He had a whole cabinet of adjustments, screws labeled with names, broken tools he said he sacrificed for control, even a voicemail from another customer saying, "I'm sorry, please stop calling my kid's school." This wasn't about business, it was about dominion. We negotiated a plea, but every time I drive past a garage now, I wonder what's sitting in the drawers behind the counter. Story 41. He was a pet behaviorist accused of animal cruelty after a neighbor reported disturbing sounds coming from his basement. He claimed it was all a misunderstanding, that he specialized in intense therapy for aggressive dogs. I figured he was just a quirky guy and over his head, until I saw his training logs. They weren't logs, they were battle records. Each animal had a name, breed, and breaking index. He'd note when they stopped growling, when they began shaking, when they lost eye contact. He called that the submission bloom. One entry read, "Took 17 hours, bit twice, heart finally cracked, beautiful." He wasn't training dogs. He was dominating them, psychologically, methodically, clinically. And worse, he had voice memos of the sessions. His tone was calm, soothing, almost loving, while the animals screamed and clawed against the concrete walls. I submitted the evidence myself. I don't do animal-related cases anymore. I couldn't. Story 42. She was a competitive chess coach, arrested for assaulting another parent at a tournament. Said it was just a heated argument. Things got out of hand. But her daughter's classmates told a different story. They described her as obsessed, forcing the girl to play 6 hours a day, banning sleepovers, cutting food as punishment for losing. I checked the court-ordered psychological evaluations. Her own child had stress-induced hair loss, panic tics, nightmares involving clocks and boards. When I brought it up, the woman said, "Pressure makes diamonds, weakness makes dancers." Then I found her notes. Not about the game, about people. Other kids. Which ones were mentally vulnerable? Which ones could be goaded into mistakes? She had dirt on rival parents, gossip weaponized to distract opponents. One child tried to quit chess entirely. That same week, someone mailed photos of his mother's DUI to every PTA member. She pled out, got parenting classes. But I saw her later that year, at another tournament, watching from the back, smiling. Story 43. He was a therapist arrested for falsifying insurance documents. Seemed like another burnout who cut corners. But his patient files were strange. Too detailed. Every session was transcribed word for word, not paraphrased, verbatim. Turns out he'd been secretly recording therapy sessions for years, and not for training purposes. He categorized them, edited clips, gave them titles like Despair Spiral Hash 7 and Betrayal Loop Sarah. His home office had headphones, speakers, and a wall of tapes, each one labeled with names, ages, triggers. When I asked him why, he said, "Pain is a perfect sound. I curate it." He wasn't a therapist. He was an emotional archivist. He got high off their stories, every tear, every confession, stored like prized records. He pled guilty to wiretapping, no charges for the manipulation. His license was revoked, but I'll always remember his last words to me. "People pay to be known. I just knew them better than they expected." Story 44? She was a wedding officiant accused of forging signatures and legal documents. She said it was an accident, blamed a faulty printer and poor eyesight. But when we examined her files, we discovered nearly 30 altered marriage licenses, all from different states, all with slightly wrong dates, slightly different names, almost like she'd done it on purpose. A deeper investigation revealed something stranger. She'd created false marriages between real people. Some didn't even know each other. Others had been dating only weeks. But somehow, the paperwork was filed, signed, and notarized, all clean. I finally asked her why. She said, "Some souls are clearly meant. They just need a little push from the universe." She believed she could see destiny. And if the world didn't obey it, she'd force it to. She pled no contest, banned from officiating, but she still advertises as a spiritual matchmaker. I wouldn't be surprised if there are more forged unions out there, bound by someone else's belief in fate. Story 45. He was an art teacher arrested for vandalism after a local sculpture park was defaced with red paint and strange symbols. He denied involvement, said it was probably angry teenagers. But his sketchbook told another story. Pages filled with mock-ups. The exact same symbols painted on the sculptures. Annotations like, "Reveals their cowardice. Start with the eyes, then flood." When I asked him about it, he said, "Art must bleed to mean anything. That park was soulless. He believed public art was dishonest. Too clean. He wanted to liberate the truth under its skin." Turns out he'd been writing anonymous critiques for years. Vicious, destructive essays about local artists. One woman had a breakdown after reading one of his reviews. He wrote beside her name in his journal, "Cracked, good sign." He didn't want to create beauty. He wanted to ruin it until it felt honest. He pled out, got community service, still teaches painting at a private studio. His reviews still show up online. Story 46. He was a city bus driver accused of threatening a passenger with a tire iron. Said it was self-defense. The guy had been harassing other riders, but when I interviewed more witnesses, something felt off. They all mentioned one thing. The driver knew too much about everyone on his route. I asked him about it. He said, "You ride long enough, you start memorizing patterns, weaknesses, sins." He wasn't exaggerating. In his locker, police found a thick binder titled "The Rot Beneath." Every page detailed passengers. Photos, notes, quotes, pages of judgmental scrawls. Sits alone after dark, hiding something. Flinches when engine revs. Guilt? He believed the bus was his judgment throne. He was guiding people to moral clarity, sometimes by threatening, sometimes by stalking. That passenger he attacked? He'd seen him kissing someone who wasn't his wife. The city fired him. Charges stuck. But I'll never forget how he stared through the courtroom window and whispered, "I still know their stops."
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.